Welcome to the Coaching and Therapy channel. So this channel is quite close to my heart because I train coaches in embodiment. I mean, why? Because if you don't work with the body, you're missing a lot. Whether you're a coach, a therapist, facilitator, whatever, that's how you go deep quickly. That's how you do stuff that's sticky. We have to take the body into account. This channel is sponsored by Dylan Newcombe and Uzazu Embodied Intelligence. Dylan is a genius, quite simply put, and I wouldn't say that about many people in this field. I've been studying with Dylan for, God, the first time was probably 10 years ago in the Netherlands. Speaks fluent Dutch, by the way, as well as Korean and a few other languages. What I love about Dylan is his ability to make models of things, looking at how embodiment works. His system, Uzazu, U-Z-A-Z-U, is really all about state shifting. So I think of him as the sort of master of state changing, how we can shift our state, our client's state, and how we can develop ourselves through those different ways of being. So I think for coaches and therapists, it's like easy to learn, practical toolkit. I've used it myself over the years. So if you want a 3-day online training with Dylan, then look at the link below, or you can go to Uzazu, uzazu.org. And even easier, he's got an embodied assessment there you can do as well. We all love doing these little tests about ourselves, but this is an embodied one. So there you go. Welcome to the Coaching and Therapy channel. I'm going to be on this one a lot just because there's lots of cool people on here. Lots of people, I think, you know, well worth a listen. Embodiment in facilitation is so necessary. So from me to you, welcome.
Nikki Rhodes. Nikki has a degree in childbirth education, in psychology and ancient history. She was a lecturer at the University of Auckland in ancient Greek and Roman medicine, where she specialized in issues surrounding women's health and sexuality in the ancient world. Nikki Rhodes is a passionate advocate and international speaker for authentic relating, and she coaches people in all things intimacy and relationship related. She's also an inspiring entrepreneur and is the co-founder of New Zealand Spirit Festival, an annual alcohol-free wellness, yoga, camping and music festival, along with Resolution New Year's Eve Festival and New Zealand Yoga Day. Truly, she is a conference renaissance lady. She could really speak in so many of the channels, and I'm delighted today that she's speaking in coaching and therapy around the perinatal period. Nikki, you have the floor. Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you so much, Matthew and Dylan and the whole team, everyone behind this conference. It's given me the opportunity to speak about something that often is not a lot of funding for, or often is not a lot of sort of apparent demand for. People are really interested within coaching and therapy around things like relationship or sex life or how to make the millions or how to sort out the issue from the past here, but at a deeper level and often a far more unglamorous level is birth. And I feel like over the years we have left birth or pushed birth into the medical professional realm, which has and continues to assist so many women and babies and families in really, really positive ways. Yet, I think how we're birthing and trends and statistics suggest that there's a lot of room for improvement. And if we look at embodiment and birth, the scope for improvement, the scope for education in this realm widens even more. So to be able to come in and speak in the embodiment conference on the importance of embodiment in the perinatal period for mothers to be, or for mothers who have had children, or for people who are involved in birth in any way, shape or form, which is all of us, this topic is vital, both as a precursor to an event that may be coming up, or as a thoughtful piece for reflection on either your own birth or on the birth of your children, whether you're a man or a woman. So yeah, so thrilled to be able to bring this to light. And I think it's so important because, you know what, we are the most well-researched, well-educated, saturated in knowledge at our fingertips. Anything we want to know, any statistic or any any detail that we desire, we've got it at our hands in terms of parenting and in terms of birth, especially I'm speaking now for the, you know, privileged Western world, largely. Yet the rates of cesarean sections, the rates of assisted birth, the rates of even just births that women are proud of, births that women felt empowered throughout, these rates, these are dwindling. And cesarean rates, like I said, are rising. Assisted births are rising. It feels as though, despite our how well educated we are and this knowledge that we have surrounding ourselves, we're struggling. And we are forgetting in many ways how to birth. We're forgetting the importance of being our own specialist. And I think it's because there is this focus from when we are very, very young on assigning our trust to the mind and to educators that fill the mind, rather than anchoring into the wisdom that lies within our bodies. In fact, we spend 13 to 14 years at school learning how to ignore the natural motions, desires, and intuition of the body instead of filling the mind. Like, the mind is the preferred place to fill, and that's dangerous. I took my children to Bali last year, and we were there for a couple of months in an attempt to completely unschool them, right? People said, oh, what are they going to do about school? I said, we're going to unschool them. We're going to remove a lot of the filling of the mind and see what comes through themselves. And they would say, you know, can I use the toilet? I said, what do you mean? Of course you can use the toilet. Or can we eat now? Or why are we eating? It's not the time to eat. And these structures and these methods have their place, right? We need this to a degree, but I think we're making a grave mistake, because essentially we are teaching humans to prioritize routine, structure, or what suits the masses over their own intuitive bodily wisdom. And when we look at birth is perhaps the most corporeal of the actions. It is rooted in the physical. And I think it accounts a lot for the confusion that many of us face. When we reach a certain point in our birth, or sorry, in our pregnancy, when we go, oh, they're asking me if they're suggesting I'm induced if nothing else happens. Or it looks as though this specialist is saying this regarding that condition. Or I read this article and that means that if I belong, you know, our minds are almost going on hyper alert. The years of training and assigning our own wisdom, or replacing our own wisdom with our mind and the actions of our mind, is replacing our own inner whispers. And it can get super dangerous when we get to this point. My interest in the perinatal period began when I was super young as well. I was 20, I was pregnant, and I really wanted to do a good job. I read so much about teen or young parents and looked at the statistics and realized that I had a lot against me. It wasn't likely I would be educated according to the statistics. It was likely that I would need a lot of intervention. It was likely that my child would grow up having less opportunities to children who were born with parents who were more stable or older or had more of their life sorted. And I really made it my mission to try and debunk all of that and prove the opposite. And so I turned to books and I read everything from things like Jean Liedloff's continuum concept, somewhat dated now, but a piece that really moved me when I read it at the time, regarding alternative ways of parenting and birthing and alternative ways of viewing birth and the whole perinatal period. Sarah Buckley, Michelle O'Donnell, so much. And what struck me the most was this discussion I actually had with a midwife, who in my stress and in my worries, I said to her, "Oh, what is a good mother and how do I become it? How do I have the birth that I want that will keep me the safest and my child the safest, yet be aligned with what I know to be true, not with what I'm told?" And this midwife had been working for many, many years, and she sat down with me and she said, "Put it this way, the most amazing mother I've ever witnessed was a 15-year-old Māori woman from New Zealand, an Indigenous woman in New Zealand, who didn't read a single book." And I sort of sat back. I said, "Really? Well, this goes against everything I've read and every judgment I've had and everything I'm trying to avoid. What do you mean?" And she said that there was something about this woman that meant she was still tapped into that ancient wisdom, that inner knowing. And she didn't allow the outside world to complicate that. She didn't allow any second guessing of what she knew. And I said, "Okay, well, tell me about her birth. What was it like?" You know, I still wanted to prove her wrong. I still wanted to say, "No, it can't, it's too easy. I'd rather grab a book and access it this way, and that feels safer for me." Yeah, my years of programming were showing through. And she said, "Well, she went into labor just on her own, and her family were nearby, still living at home, and her partner was nearby, but she knew she needed to be in silence and to be alone. So she spent the whole day at home birthing and laboring with herself and her body, moving as she wanted to. We were in touch because she was the midwife, and I encouraged her to follow what she knew to be true. And as she, as things progressed, her partner was invited into the room of support, and he provided a really welcome, a welcome break in the energy, a welcome refreshment in the energy from when she was alone to having support, and also a pillar so she could hold on to, and her body could, some of the weight she was carrying, she was able to pass on to her partner. And then it was time to have her father and her mother involved. And they drove her in. She wanted to give birth at the hospital, and they drove her in. And as she pulled up, she was offered the wheelchair to go in. And she said that felt like that would be a removal of the power she had been so bravely cultivating in the hours of labor. And so she said no to the wheelchair, and she walked in to the hospital, big walk all the way in. And as she walked in, she became fully dilated. She went into the room, she stood up, placed her hands on the hospital bed, and into the arms of her young, beautiful partner, the father-to-be, this baby was birthed in almost silence, in almost orgasmic happiness, with her mother and her father side by side. And she went on to parent in a very similar way. And this story, I don't know, stories have the power of transmission that I think a textbook doesn't. And this story transformed my entire parenting experience. I went on to have not only one baby at 20, but three before I was 24. And the power of that story and the wisdom that that instilled in me to trust in myself and to make birth an embodiment process also laid the foundation for my later study when I moved into the spiritual. When I moved into, in my 30s, my early 30s, I decided that I wanted to understand more about essentially existentialism, but through a esoteric or through an ancient lens. I loved yoga. I loved the body as the means for transcendence, and studying traditional tantra in India, whereby the goal is not to escape the physical. Transcendence doesn't happen, well, enlightenment doesn't happen when we leave our body. There's it's amazing to sit alone in a cave and meditate and drop all need or attachment to the physical self. But true enlightenment happens when we really embrace the incarnation that we are. And we have sex, and we poo, and we birth, and we growl. And it's about embracing and owning and diving into every crevice. And this spoke to me deeply. And the more I looked into this, I realized this, that our biology is a potent reflection of our biography. And that the stories we tell ourselves, the baggage that we subconsciously pick up and chuck over our shoulder, the specialists that we listen to who perhaps are more anchored in their androcentric view of birth or their time schedule or their training or their own fear-based capsule, that we subconsciously or maybe painstakingly unaware lift up and carry. This is what we bring to birth. That really crappy sex education that we had back at high school, we picked that up too, and that's residing on us as well. And we come to our birth period, we come to the perinatal period often laden with these weights of conditioning from society, of stories told by our parents or our educators, and sometimes their own misguided, unprocessed pain. What we witnessed growing up, the TV, women laying on their back, pushing out babies. I mean, right now, consider doing a poo on your back, lying flat on your back and attempting to push out a poo. I tell my people this in their class, in my childbirth education classes. I would say, right now, feel into it. And I make them close their eyes. You know, let's do it right now. Close our eyes and envision lying on our back and trying to push out a poo. In this moment, I'm immensely grateful for gravity and for my inner knowing that gravity is the answer here that can be worked with. Because to be honest, the only memory most people have of lying on their back pushing out a poo is when they have been intoxicated or unable to choose otherwise. Because if we can choose otherwise, then we will utilize gravity, right, to let this happen. So the whole myth or the whole, what do we call it, cultural phenomenon of pooing on our back, I mean, sorry, of birthing on our back, belongs to a couple of things, but most commonly associated with Henry VIII many, many years ago, well, actually not that many years ago, when it was vital the gender of the baby became more and more important as he was looking for an heir. And for him to just pop in the room, you know, into women's business briefly, because he didn't want to have much to do with it, and check that gender as soon as possible, it made disposing of the female much quicker, right, if it was not what he wanted. And so when we go into a procedure, when we grow up as a little girl, or even as a boy, thinking, okay, women give birth on their back, this is what we see on TV, this is what we see, this is what happens. We set ourselves up, we envision, you know, through our subconscious intention setting, we set ourselves up for a really difficult experience. Because pushing a baby out, of course, is a lot more difficult than pushing out a poo, right? And by difficult, I mean, is a lot more moving through, right, the body. And if we look at things like the pelvic floor muscles, there is immense stress on the pelvic floor as the baby descends in an upright, gravity-assisted position. But you can double the amount of strain and unnecessary pressure on the pelvic floor muscles when you lie a woman on her back and expect her to literally push her child uphill because of the placing of the coccyx and other areas. Immense stress not only for the mother, but for another key participant of the birth, and that is the baby itself, who already goes through an immense amount of trauma, right, coming through. So when we look at embodiment, perhaps one of the first things or the most telling or one of the saddest images is seeing a woman give birth on her back in a time or in a process which is meant to be deeply embodied, which by its very nature is a wild, freeing thing where it feels like, to me, she should be fully abled. She should not be disabled in a sense. And throughout this talk, you know, I'm referring also, I want to pay homage to the medical profession who have saved millions and millions of lives in the processes and the procedures that I'm sometimes speaking about with a little bit of disdain. But I feel that there has become an overuse of practices. And the statistics reflect this. The statistics of cesarean births or intervention, which always leads in most cases to a woman being on her back, show a rise. These are happening at a measurable increase every single year. I've made some notes, you know, in terms of cesarean rates, the World Health Organization says that ultimately these should stay between 10, maximum 15% of all births worldwide. Because cesarean section is associated, you know, it's not without its risk. And it's not to scare people, it's not to frighten them, it's not to instill more fear, but it's important that it remains as an emergency procedure for women who either choose it with their full being for reasons that are deeply important to them, or as a life-saving measure for mother or baby or both. But too often we're seeing a trend whereby scheduling or whereby societal pressure to return to work or to many, many, many reasons why women are favoring or why we're seeing this increase. The increase is stark. If we look at the worldwide rate, if the World Health Organization say between 10 and 15%, currently, the cesarean rate is looking more like 20% of the world. This is one in every five births being born by cesarean, 10% more than what the World Health Organization says. And a couple of case studies here for the USA is sitting at around 32, 33%. And other countries, in particular Turkey, are looking at more like 51% of all births. That's one in every two births being born by cesarean section. And we're really not too sure the full effects of a cesarean section, because studies continue to be released and highlight different effects that these births or these ways that we are birthing are showing, right? As the rates increase, we're able to pick out or to notice more trends. And one of the biggest trends that we're seeing here, just like our environment, is becoming so much less diverse, right? If it's the rainforest or if it's in species diversity, our own inner rainforest, our own inner microbiomes are becoming so much less diverse than what they were even 20 years ago, even 40 years ago. And we weren't too sure about what that even meant that long ago. It didn't really seem to matter. Bacteria is a bad thing anyway, right? Oh, no way. 3.5 kilos of bacteria reside in our gut on average in any given moment. 3.5 kilos of bacteria, and studied with, well, compared to a tribe in the Amazon. The name escapes me right now. We have something like 80% less diversity, 80%. And what we're noticing is that the gut is, you know, responsible for so much more than just digestion as a second brain, as a preventative for behavioral conditions that are confusing us yet arising at a huge rate. And what we're noticing is that something pretty magical happens when a baby is birthed through the vagina or through the birth canal. as the baby's face literally faces the anus of the mother, she is colonized, or the baby, he or she is colonized, her whole gut, through the mouth, through the face, as it emerges through the canal with the mother's bacteria. So attempts in the 50s and 60s in New Zealand to sterilize the vagina through enemas or through shaving or through swabbing or all this kind of stuff with antiseptic wipes created such a disturbance to what nature knew was most important for that baby. The baby faces the back or the anus, and then the baby twists around, right, before she's birthed because of the shoulders. And what we're noticing now, only 5 years ago in New Zealand anyway, the midwives, after the cesarean birth, were swabbing with a tissue and a little stick, the yoni or the vagina, and wiping it around the baby's mouth and face after a cesarean birth to try and reproduce some of that, you know, allow the mother's bacteria, which is most natural, to be the first to colonize the baby's gut. And they were blocked only a couple of years ago by obstetricians and gynecologists who said, no, we haven't heard of this yet. Now it's becoming far more practiced, and I'm sure most people on here are aware of it. But when we start to really stuff with some pretty natural processes, like birth, like the body's intuitive knowing, because my mind didn't tell me the baby will come out the back, then I'm going to need to sort of do something to make it twist and come out. But it just did it. And in our attempt to control nature, to control birth, to control the wild, we're making a grave mistake. A grave mistake. Babies born by cesarean are more likely to be obese, to have autism, to have learning difficulties, asthma, allergies increase. I don't even want to exact amounts. I'm not too sure. It changes per study. But the body's wisdom, and that story I told at the beginning with the young Māori woman, she didn't need any Google search to tell her that what she knew to be true was true. And I think that we can drown in our own fears that we're not enough and that our bodies don't know, or perhaps that removal of intuitive wisdom that was replaced at school, or what we witnessed our own mothers do, or our own sisters or our friends. If we jump on that bandwagon, we are at grave risk of ignoring perhaps the greatest guru we will ever encounter, which is ourselves. And if we are uncomfortable in our bodies, if we are uncomfortable about our processes, about our need to pass urine or poo or vomit, or if we are obsessed with cleanliness and sterility and the outside, the shiny, then we miss the journey home. And the search for the external becomes an addiction. And when we go to birth, and when we are confronted with our own changeable bodies and our own leakage of fluids or huge initiation into the physical, this can be too much. This can be too confronting, especially in a society that has not prepped us for full ownership of ourselves. And I'd like to say now, it begins, you know, this whole importance of embodiment in the perinatal period, it begins when we are at PE and health class at school. It begins there. Yeah, it begins where we learn how to relate with another, when we learn about our permission or our rights when it comes to communication and expressing our needs. Because our body can't speak, you know, the vagina can't say, hey, look, I am going to take 30 hours in pre-labor, but I'm fine. So give me that time, then things will speed up and we'll be okay. Just don't go interfering in the beginning process. It can't speak. This speaks. This is the only thing that can speak. So if we don't learn from when we're young, when we're at high school, when we're learning the sex ed stuff, that we can speak our desires, or that the genitals, every part of our body, but especially our genitals, has a consciousness and a wisdom that's not acknowledged, not talked about at school. It's super unlikely that your health or sex ed teacher is going to have done the work and really own this themselves. But if we are able to teach our young people that things that they feel, desires that they have, sensations that they know to be true for themselves, it's their duty to voice it. It's their duty to stay connected with it and to know it means something. That then when that woman is in the perinatal period, that when that woman is about to give birth, she's already got a highway, a clean highway of connection and communication to her body. And her body knows that it can signal, it can speak, and that she will listen. And when she listens, she can feel confident to speak it. And when more women and more men do this, then we reduce the dysfunction in intimacy. We lose the problem right now, which is suffocating our intimate relationships, is our fear, of speaking to what's alive within us. And I go back, I think this really is anchored at in an education sense at school. To go further back, you know, studies continuously show that if you want your children to have a healthy, intimate, positive, and fulfilling sex and relationship life, relating life, then you must demonstrate it. That how our parents communicated their desires, how our parents fought, and then how our parents made up. Because often we don't see that bit, we just see the fight. How our parents speak of our own birth experiences. How our parents take radical self-responsibility for how they contributed to various relationships or marriages or all births, working out how they wanted or how they didn't. How they come back into empowerment from perhaps aspects or times when they could have chosen victimhood. This here plays a huge role on how our children grow up to perceive the world and to perceive their ability to communicate their own needs or desires. So the importance of embodiment in the perinatal period begins with your children, begins as children and what is witnessed. And if you did not witness that, if that was not something that was common for you and you are in the perinatal period now and you are feeling into what's approaching and feeling terrified by this initiation into your physical, which perhaps for years you may have avoided, or there may have been times of self-loathing, or there may have been times where any substance to escape this physical felt more safe than being at home in the body, or there was trauma that you have been able to not look at for a while, and now that you're pregnant, you are you're being forced to stare at. There's a path for you, and there's still a possibility. There's still the choice to become at home in yourself is still very possible. And the begins, I would say, through an empowering yet confronting process, which is taking radical self-responsibility for exactly where you're at right now. Whether you are looking for an induction, you know, heading towards an induction tomorrow, or where the pregnancy is approaching up ahead and you feel nervous about the journey, whether, you know, wherever stage you're at, taking radical self-responsibility for your own relationship to yourself and not to an idea or an egoic mask of yourself, but to like yourself, to like the lumps and the bumps and the processes that occur within your body. I think that if it starts at child, you know, with the whole childbirth, you're as a child, and then it's also reinforced throughout sex ed or physical education classes, a huge place there, I mean, a massive role. I say that, I take us right back to there, because I taught sex ed and I taught childbirth education for many years to a whole bunch of teen mothers. I was so moved by that story regarding the Māori woman that I shared at the beginning, and also by my own birth, that I witnessed this whole sector of society. New Zealand has an alarmingly high, actually, teen mother rate, teen parent rate, that I contacted a local teen pregnancy unit or teen parent unit and got the job there of teaching both history and classics and math, of history, classics and English, and also sex ed. But the sex ed part came later, because I would show up to the school with these mothers. My youngest mother was 12. She had given birth when she was 12 and a half, and she had a small baby boy. My oldest mother was 16, and there was many in between. And they would arrive at the school, and they would put the baby in the daycare below, and they would go down and feed it when they would get the call, and they would be able to sit and do their homework. It's amazing, great, great system. Food would be brought in, perfect. And they would sit there and I would be trying to teach them about Achilles or myth or, you know, something exciting about the ancient world. I crafted the topics to be really interesting for them. And they would be distant. They would be in the mind, they would be lost, they would be anywhere but where I wanted them to be. And I became frustrated, you know, it's like, come on. This, you got your own teacher. There's so much here. Drop in. Look at this material. But there's no way that we can properly focus on the other or another or the external if we are not home within ourselves. And these children were so moved, were so unprocessed through what they had been through. And no one had guided them through being a teenager and being a mother and then being in the post-birth stages, but also sort of only 1 year into your menstrual cycle. And that really important embodiment piece was missing from their whole education. So I scrapped the whole thing and said, stuff the good Achilles stories and the myths. We're going to go right back now. And we're going to start the day with embodiment. And we started the day by moving them, by getting them into their bodies, by answering what I felt were like the most basic questions about sex and intimacy and their body, talking about basic anatomy, which no one had bothered really to share with them, not throughout the whole birth process. Got them speaking about their birth. What happened? At what point were you not empowered, and at what point were you empowered? Because some had had inductions and had felt empowered the whole time. And others had had the same thing happen, but had felt like it was not told to them, or they hadn't processed it wasn't right. And we know now, no matter what happens in the birth experience, if the mother feels like she was empowered in the decision-making process throughout, like the consent piece, then her experience of the birth, her ability to move forward with her life, her ability to bond with her baby is almost guaranteed to be more positive than if she hadn't. So I played this role with these young girls, and they shared and they spoke. And in so many of their cultures, this was not allowed. This was not talked about. This was shameful, just like the pooing, just like the sex, just like all of that. And they pieced together often where they had been kept in the dark. Had I known this before, I don't think I would have got pregnant, miss, they said. And so acknowledging the body's wisdom, imagine if they were armed with the gifts of coming home to themselves, if they were taught that their body will give signs at all stages. if we were taught that, there are so many decisions I think that we would have avoided making at certain times of our life. So in an attempt to sort of reduce or remove risk from birth, I feel we have over-medicalized the process massively. In our attempt to be fear adverse, we have become fear positive. Well, we have increased fear because women and men are favoring an external source over that which really has all the answers. And things like even breastfeeding rates directly correspond, there is a correspondence in successful breastfeeding rates to births where women felt empowered. Women felt like they could bond with their babies. Women felt like their identity was still intact in some form or another post-birth. Because, of course, the perinatal period doesn't stop the minute the woman gives birth. In fact, I remember being my partner, I stood up and I birthed my baby standing up, and my partner reached under and the midwife said, "Do you want gloves?" And he said, "Yeah," and of course not. And the baby fell into his arms and he held the baby up and he's like, "Wow." And I held the baby too and I was like, "Oh, what now?" Right? What? I read the things, I got the Māori woman transmission, the birth, but what now? And the perinatal period, you know, of course, extends for at least that first year. It extends forever, but by definition to the first year. And breastfeeding is such an important part because it's that continual submission to the whisperings of the body. It's that continuous, like just when you think that you're done with the physical and you can get back in the job or back in the thing, breastfeeding is that rhythmical reminder that the body is speaking. It's intuitive needs or reminders of the baby's needs. Again, the World Health Organization recommends 2 years of breastfeeding because breastfeeding benefits, although still being discovered, are phenomenal. From IQ rates that are so much higher, you know, quantitatively measurably more than for IQ, the IQ rates that are higher in breastfed babies more than 6 months than babies who weren't breastfed for 6 months. To gut support, to bonding, to right development of the brain with the left and right hemispheres, to so much. And we're looking actually at 2% of women globally breastfeeding for 24 months or for 2 years. 2%. And amongst that, we're looking at 1-5% maximum of women globally who can't breastfeed. So if 1-5% of women globally cannot produce enough, yet 98% of women aren't choosing to. It's pretty full on. You know, breastfeeding benefits also reduce risk of SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome, reduce allergies, which are on massive increase around the world. So it doesn't just stop there. You know, the importance of the embodiment period. That little baby, my one, she grew up, now she's 13, and she's looking at me like, "All right, how embodied is my mum?" The lessons don't end there. How much is my mum, what she's talking, reflected in how she's acting? And isn't that a great thing we often say about our parents? Our dad was really good at saying this stuff, but he didn't really live it. We are infatuated on a subconscious level with people walking their talk. And the physical, although has been replaced with this focus on the mental, remains super, super important. Looking at the time, I would like to open it if there are any questions. It doesn't look like anything has been put in at the moment, but if there's anyone listening that has a particular question around the importance of embodiment in the perinatal period, then I'd be so willing to share anything from my experience as a teen mum, or working with teen mums, to my experience as a childbirth educator teaching in the community for many years, couples who wanted the best for their baby, wanted the best for themselves. Matthew, did I see you?
I have a loads of questions, sorry.
Yeah, hit me.
It's our field. As an osteopath, supporting mums in establishing pregnancies, so the complications that lead to infertility and how to support them resolving that to preparing for childbirth or treating babies afterwards. You talked about radical responsibility in a moment prior to childbirth. And there's that unpacking of that. When somebody has embedded and enmeshed, whether that's trauma in armoring areas around the pelvic floor, whether that's the amount of fear that comes in through watching films, watching television, being told about people's nightmare birth stories and the anguish that creates. How would you support somebody in establishing responsibility in that so that they can, even at that last minute, find somewhere in that Maori story that grounds them, holds them, supports them, and enables them to drop into their body and find a wisdom that will get through that? How do you support that?
Yeah. I feel like we can be quite afraid of becoming really honest with where we are at. And I think that's where you've got to start. I think there's a lot of sugarcoating or, yeah, sort of, or maybe, or could be that thing. But encouraging my clients or people I work with to become really clear or really, really okay with how not okay it is currently. The fertility troubles or heartbreak or whatever it happens to be, becoming really honest with themselves and feeling into their body, like where is it sitting? Where is it hiding? And what part of the body is energetically holding that resistance or that fear? Where did all those negative birth stories store in the physical?
Yep.
And then really working from that place, because the numbness in the pelvic floor area is like a pandemic. And there are multiple reasons for it, but they all lead to crappy sexual experiences and problems often with fertility, as well as a plethora of other issues. I think also to speak to that is immersing themselves. Once that is identified, immersing themselves in things like tell me a positive birth story, making sure they provide an antidote for every negative one by reading Spiritual Midwifery by Ina May Gaskin or something completely around the other side.
Yes.
Taking radical self-responsibility for giving themselves the education that perhaps was stolen from them.
Mm. Yes, I had some good conversations along those sort of lines with birth doulas that support mums. In those very immediate moments that follow those sort of lines.
Yeah, and that's another thing. Get a doula. Seek out a doula. Seek out a doula to champion your rights if you know that you go silent in the face of authority. Know that someone in a white coat could trigger you, and know that having a doula who will champion your rights or your desires that may disappear when you're in front of the medical profession is key. And also someone who knows when it is time to listen or time to consider what they're saying, because that's always a fine line. No one's forcing the negative on you, but there's a certain amount of standing up for oneself that's often not done.
Yes. Somebody has that, they can act as an advocate for you and support you in that moment is quite key. Medical authority, judicial authority can really jump on the frontal cortex and shut down everything.
Yes. Totally. As soon as this is activated, yeah, completely. That genital wisdom, that physical wisdom that we're speaking of, consciousness, that disappears if the prefrontal cortex is activated.
Yeah, last thing that should be involved and invoked in childbirth is not that there, it's the old rhombencephalon that's monitoring and supporting an effective expression of birth.
I remember being asked to, they wanted to drink some water with a straw or without a straw. It's quite a simple question. It requires a fast answer. And I remember being right in transition when asked this by some well-meaning person, but someone who obviously has never been birthing. And I remember almost wanting to throw the cup of water out of the room, because the question just seemed so complex and took me straight out of my experience. So yeah, it's so super vital to have someone else answering for you.
It is. There's a relationship between the frontal cortex and the rhombencephalon in childbirth. It's really important to understand in supporting effective birth. There's a biological reason for it. All mammals share the same dynamic. It's the frontal cortex is there to be on alert and get you out of the cave. There's a predator around. Yeah. And its role is to shut down birth in that dynamic, in that moment. It's the last thing that should be being invoked. So even questions about straws or sipping from a cup can impact on a birth experience. Being asked or being having language around pain rather than contractions or waves or surges has a huge impact on the effectiveness of laboring.
Completely. And I want to flick now to something that happens for a lot of people, you know, in their day-to-day lives, is this difficulty that some women say, oh, it takes me a long time to become aroused, if I compare it, say, to an intimate setting. Oh, it takes me a long time to orgasm, or I just, things pop in my mind, or it's a similar function. Yeah. Our bodies are not going to relax and to open and to we're not going to expand into our full pleasure capacity if we're in the mind, if we deem something to be unsafe. It's not there's something wrong with us. But when we're birthing and when we're taking too long, or when there are time frames around how long stage one, stage two, whatever should be, then our prefrontal cortex is even slightly switched on. Our body is not going to drop into that space. And that's why birth centers have tried to create environments that stimulate home, right? Stimulate soft, welcoming spaces. My midwife was always outside the room. You know, it didn't need to be right there. When she came in, it would slow down slightly, my labor. Mother cat will never birth in the center of the floor. You know, she'll hide in a cupboard, or you wake up the next day and she's made a little nest in the spare room, right? Mammals are similar in this sense.
Yep. And if you go and find, you go and look for her and put a light on in there, whoop, she'll shut, the labor will slow down. She's much more likely to have uterine inertia and need to go to the vets. Absolutely.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For the same reasons. For the same reasons we share with all mammals. Yeah. Hmm. Coming back to something you were talking about earlier about the vaginal biome and that relationship, there's a whole load of good science. There was a super film, like struggling to remember the name of it. Professor Sue Downey, who's a consultant midwife, was one of the people interviewed on the film. It's about 4 years ago, looking at how we adopt and co-opt that biome, how that's supported and how critical that is. Do you remember the name of the film?
No, I don't. I don't remember the name, but we'll put it in the comments.
Because that's not airy fairy idea. It's quite critical to our well-being.
No, it's critical to our survival as a species, right?
Yes.
We're really unaware of what we're messing with as we medicalize birth more and more and more. And we think if we come out alive, that's it. Yep. Oh, safe baby. Yep. Mother and baby alive. Good. Yes. But how we birth is so important.
There's a whole lot of research on vaginal bacteria being the source of the next super antibiotics to dealing with antibiotic resistant diseases. Yeah, and that's where the store of it is. And our gut biome, should be about 400 different types of bacteria. Now we're down to about 120 if we're good in Western society, but that's not the norm either. Yeah, so
Child.
Okay.
In ancient Greece and Rome, like I said before, my studies there, there were whisperings or recordings of a Persian, or priest from Asia Minor, who would drink the fluid from the woman's vagina, right, through female ejaculation as kind of like a superfood for their gods and for, well, they would say, would give them sort of physical prowess. And the Greeks and Romans and us, we all sort of laugh at that and whatever, whatever. But, you know, after you just said that, if you know, they may have been onto something very, very powerful.
Yep. Fantastic. Fantastic.
Amazing.
I think we've got a couple more minutes left. Is there any other insight that from radical responsibility, supporting a practical aspect of that, when somebody has armoured their pelvis so and in the state of fear, what would you support a mum going through struggles in transition? How would you see the best kind of support in transition from first stage into, well, yeah, really making that bridge?
Yeah, powerful. Because often that's the key point where we get intervention, we get unnecessary, and we know what that looks like, right? Other options. Other options are promotion of oxytocin, right? In any kind of way, shape, or form. And Ina May Gaskin, she will always speak of the partner playing a beautiful role here in fostering safety within the mom. And that can through physical touch or through whatever her love language is, words or stimulation or however much they want to do that. But lights down, room off, and completely enclosing them. Now, often, even with the partner, there's still an armored pelvic floor or it's not happening. So getting the woman to really connect with herself in a non-confrontational way that's likely to spark more fear, but encouraging her to touch herself or to hold herself, to really feel her physical body, or to feel what's going on, to come home or become present to the moment, can be confronting, but can also can be something to try in those just before major intervention happens. And guided or music or candles or oils or something she's prepped throughout the pregnancy for this perhaps to happen, so she's familiar with it doesn't seem alien or terrifying, would be mine.
Okay, I have to wrap this up. This is agony.
Yeah. just we just keep going.
The depth of the wisdom that you share, you could share with us all. Okay. There are Facebook groups that we can jump on and be part of that would extend this conversation. By all means, jump on and join us with some of those. I want to extend this somehow. These talks are one of many sharing embodied wisdom. They're free for 48 hours. After that, buy them, buy the package. There's so much wisdom in this conference that we couldn't possibly pick it up all in one go. Join us for other aspects of it too. Nikki, there's one last question. Mm-hmm. Top tip for embodiment. What is your one top tip for embodiment you can share with us all?
Top tip for embodiment. They have to come back to the radical self-responsibility piece. You know, do not be afraid of coming home to yourself and getting really, really real with the ways in which you're avoiding doing so.
Yeah. Show up for life. Be fully you.
Show up. Yeah. Show up for you. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like we do it for the baby or for the man. Or, no, for you.
Yeah. Thank you, Nikki. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Matthew.